You are listening to Fika with Vicky on United Public Radio, 107.7 and 105.3 from New Orleans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fika. That was almost perfect, except for that little slip click there. So we're going good. Our guest today is Ira Sonia Moon. Ira Sonia is an author, witch, international teacher, poet, death care worker, and reclaiming initiate. Today, we're going to focus on her books, Reclaiming Witchcraft and Honoring the Wild, learning all about the reclaiming witchcraft tradition. And I confess, I have learned a lot reading over the past few weeks from her books. Number one is this, and the confession continues. Several years ago, my family and I were at a pagan festival, and a gentleman introduced himself to my son as a dragon who protected the witches. Never having heard of such a thing, he was perplexed and asked me about it. I too was perplexed, having never heard of such a thing. And so over the years, we have had several theories, as you can imagine. While reading Ira Sonia's writing about rituals and security at festivals, this quote came up. There are also dragons, for example, that can help to answer questions and engage with people who are disruptive, not sober, or causing harm in some other way. And so, thank you, Ira Sonia. Mystery was solved for us and understanding achieved. This was a person whose title was dragon and whose responsibility was to take care of the witches. We're also going to be delving into her book, Aphrodite, and learn what drew her to this particular deity. And so we have a lot to learn and a lot of understanding to achieve today. Welcome to Fika.
Thank you so much, Vicky. I'm very excited to be here and so glad to hear about your dragon connection. I think it's always great. It's so interesting to hear when certain things like pop for people.
It was. I couldn't wait for my son after, it's got to be 10 years. After 10 years, I was just laughing and I'm like, oh, I can't wait for him to get off of work so I can say, I found the answer. So
yes, great.
So, since we're getting started, why don't we start with basics? Can you tell us what reclaiming witchcraft is?
Yes. So, reclaiming witchcraft is a tradition of witchcraft that was started in the San Francisco Bay Area in the U.S. It started out of basically a whole bunch of different events and sort of things going on in that area, the crucible that is San Francisco. But basically, it started with this idea of folks sort of coming together, like this reemergence of goddess spirituality. There was a lot of activism going on at the moment and a bunch of other things. And this woman named Starhawk was writing a thesis dissertation on goddess spirituality and started to get people together and people who wanted to create their own rituals. And basically they got together and learned how to build rituals together and make magic. And suddenly that became what is now one of the core classes of reclaiming called Elements of Magic. But to make a long story short, basically folks kept getting together and it kind of grew and grew and grew and became this big group of folks who were doing magic together, who were participating in various activist protests and actions and things like that, and became such a large group that it actually couldn't quite sustain itself anymore. It was too big. And so the collective dissolved and some folks got together and created these tenets called the Principles of Unity to sort of hold what was most important in reclaiming at that moment. And then basically said, you know, this is the tradition now called reclaiming witchcraft. If you abide by these, you know, principles of unity, you can call yourself a reclaiming witch. And from there, reclaiming is far beyond California at this point. Groups in Australia, Canada, the UK, I think Belgium is starting. I'm going to forget some countries in Europe, also Brazil, and all throughout the US too. And probably other places I just don't know about.
So it's one of those things where the internet is very positive because it allows people to meet others of similar interest in other areas. Mm-hmm. So you were sort of reclaiming and all of those things for everybody, but also reclaiming yourselves within that group.
Yeah, I think of it as reclaiming power, right? And reclaiming power that is not the power over or the power to manipulate and things like that. Figuring out how to reclaim personal power and collective power in order to create change and hopefully positive change in the world and, you know, in ourselves.
And so you say to create change within the world in itself, that takes a little bit of organization within the group.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
So first things first, before we get into those complications, let's not start with the craziness that is people working
together. Let's not go back behind the curtain just yet. Yes.
So what are some of the things that they've done throughout history or working on now?
So Reclaiming has been involved in a whole bunch of different things. And I want to, before I even go into that, I want to say that while there are the principles of unity and things that we as a tradition agree to, it looks different for different folks. And so you can't say like a Reclaiming Witch is just this. Which made, you know, writing my book really difficult because there isn't really just one. There's some similarities, but there's not just one. I often say reclaiming is often, but not always. So I would say that some of the things that we've been most as a group involved in, a lot of environmental activism as evidenced by the stories in Honoring the Wild, a lot of activism around oppression and around, you know, racism and anti-racist practices or movements, I should say, anti-transphobia, all of the different ways in which folks are being oppressed and how can we step in and help folks, join with folks, support folks. And it's an ongoing thing because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but a lot of humans, even with the best of intentions, screw up. And so we're still learning, we're still figuring it out. There's still things we're not doing well. But that's, you know, meeting, I think, society and where things are in this moment is what we can do.
Well, so you can say fighting, but you could also say bringing out the nurturing aspects of life, like nurturing nature, nurturing people individually. And not that I have a problem with the whole warrior concept.
I'm just saying
it is focused on the nurturing aspects of life.
I think that is brilliant to say, because I think that a lot of folks have activist in their head as someone who is up in the tree with, you know, Julia Butterfly Hill or is chained to something. Activism looks a whole bunch of different ways. And I think that's great. And I think it offers folks who are like, I don't have time to stand in front of a building for days and days, that there are different entry points. There is the nourishing. There is the, how can I help behind the scenes? How can I make sure that folks can do these things? How can I get mutual aid? How can I, you know, set up the GoFundMe to support this person who got arrested? Things like that. There's different ways to support. And I think you're right on with nurturing and nourishing being part of that conversation.
Well, because it is, I mean, there's a lot of things that you say, why don't people do stuff? That in your writing, I was like, yes, and this could apply to me in several different situations or whatever. Sure. But definitely in the idea that activism is difficult for some people because of what they've lived before. And so they second guess themselves, and they themselves are in need of nourishment and nourishing themselves because they don't trust themselves in making decisions.
And we're also, society is really, I think, let's say as a whole, set up for folks to not do this sort of work, you know, to keep people in certain situations and certain economic situations or, you know, society isn't necessarily very community minded all the time. And so it makes it hard to do things that are stepping outside of that because you don't have the resources or the support. And of course, that makes people, you know, feel stuck and then maybe feel guilty, which is, you know, don't feel guilty for where you're at. You do the best you can. But I think it's a really complicated and nuanced conversation about activism. But I think what I want to bring forward is that there's something I think everyone can do.
Whatever. And that was very, those were all points that were brought up in the book was the, okay, the world does tend to make you feel guilty if you do or guilty if you don't, right? Sure. So, you know, we all try the best that we can. For example, when my kids were small, you know, I did like the cloth thing, and then you get into the diapers, and then you get into, well, then you're using up the water. And I just decided, regardless of anything, I'm never going to criticize a new mom on what she's doing because she has enough going on. Okay. It doesn't seem to matter what you do. The lack of guilt, like that, that there were examples. If you get the big book, people, there's an example of how they showed that everybody was doing whatever they can. And at that moment, and yes, money, resources, you have to work two jobs. You don't have time to defend yourself as far as other things go. And and so there's a lot of reasons that people may not do that. But this group would offer some suggestions or insights or if you don't know how to get started on that yourself.
Yeah. And I think when I was writing or I was compiling Honoring the Wild, I realized it was going to be really disingenuous to just include a bunch of like success stories in activism. Like it just didn't, that's not realistic. Like it doesn't always work out. It doesn't. And also, so I did have some folks who were really courageous to say like, I don't really consider myself an activist. And yet I'm still in this tradition. There's a place for me too. And I think that's great because I think that's more of what the greater society is sort of like my activism is more about bringing stories forward and I can donate at times. I have been in actions and protests, but it kind of, as my life has changed, my ability to do things has changed and that's okay. Like if we stopped having like what I think is like the activist Olympics, I think that it would be really helpful. There is no medal for being the best at this.
I'm writing this down too. Okay.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe there is one and I just don't know it, but I'm not vying for that anymore. It is kind of part of activist circles to be like, well, you're not doing enough. So, well then we're pushing people away and well, that's not okay.
It's doing the shaming. In a group that's supposed to be against shame.
If you want to have shame and guilt, please go back to Christianity. There's plenty of it there. And, you know, I mean, I think that regret is an okay thing to feel sometimes like, oh, I regret that I did that. Like that's informative, right? But shame tends to be the thing that I think I've said before, like shame does not like encourage like better behavior. Like shame is not a good like motivator. That's what I've said. Shame's not a good motivator.
No, it creates hiding. I mean, it's even guilt comes about shaming, I think, because it can say, okay, enough of this. I'm not going to feel this way anymore. But shaming comes from something deeper. Childhood.
Yeah. Well, shame is very much like I'm not a good person. Not I did it. I didn't do a good thing. You know, it's like it's about you as the person. And that's we all have inherent value and worth regardless of what we do. And not that people won't have feelings about stuff. But I wish that we could move into what I have is also valuable. And please, like you have a talent. Why not bring it out somehow?
It's that we're inconveniences. We feel like we're inconveniences. So to learn that you're not an inconvenience and that people can take time to listen to your idea is a biggie, I think.
I think so too. And I think one of the, I don't know, I think that social media has been really helpful in sort of getting people to hear stories of other folks and what they've done. I mean, I think social media has other qualities to it that aren't the best. But I think that that does help. And that's why I wanted to bring a bunch of stories into things, because I think stories like influence us more than here's a list of what you should do.
Because that's what I put. This is what I, this is where I connected with, several places I connected. But one of the most important places was when you wrote, I'm not going to look up the quote now, but when you wrote, you know, tell me what to do. It's not happening. But give me a story, show me some experiences, and I'll listen. And that is so important. You want to hear from those who've been there before, right? You
want. Absolutely.
And that's how society always learned before it became a textbook.
Right.
And this is how you do it. And if you don't do it that way, baby, you just failed.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that it's one of the disconnects for white folks in supporting BIPOC and all of their incredible challenges and injustices. As a white person, I think it's hard to like look at, oh, what should I do when I'm not like relating to stories and meeting people for who they are. Like it will create a disconnect, or I've seen that happen. It's when I can listen more than I talk. And I can listen to where people are coming from and how this is impacting folks, where I can actually cultivate empathy. And that is really where it inspires like action, instead of going to it from, okay, if I just do these things, then everything's okay. Maybe that's not what people are asking for.
No, you have to listen to their experience. They have to be the ones you listen to, because otherwise it's just hearsay. And this is, are you deciding what they want from your perspective?
White saviorism. Yes.
Yeah. So, well, you can't, everybody has to save themselves ultimately. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. But you can help with tools or whatever, maybe not suggestions, but you know, whatever you can give. But no, the story and to take that beyond just to listen to their cultural stories, their original stories, you get an idea of who people are through that.
I think building relationships is probably one of the best strategies for figuring out how you can be supportive, how you can be an ally or an accomplice, or however you want to phrase it, to folks, is by listening and actually getting to know folks and building relationships. That is what I think our society has sort of pushed us from, like being hyper individualized, disconnects us from that. And I think everything becomes a conversation about versus being about people and actual people who are being impacted by environmental change, by the various levels of oppression in different ways.
Well, and then that can get confusing for even the people in, say, that town, because there's the need. We don't have money. We need to have work, but that work is going to give us other problems. So what I think we've lost is the ability to discuss without having to be right.
Well, yes. That is tricky. Humans are humaning a lot. And it's a lot of like societal, you know, we've been taught these things, they're ingrained in society. So it's hard to break away from it. And it's hard to see it sometimes. So it really requires a lot of courage and a lot of willingness to be wrong, like you said.
And that's why reading a book, to bring it back, like reclaiming witchcraft is more a how-to and a historical.
Yeah.
Right? And then honoring the wild is more of a story, people's experiences and their stories.
Yeah.
And Ira Sonia is saying, now I know this isn't everybody and I'm not going to get everybody.
She was very cautious
for that. But that's when we read about these things or people's traditional stories or whatever, we have to keep our mouth shut while we're reading. So we can get that stuff in there, take the time to think before we have to be out there with all of it.
Right. Yes, right. Absolutely. And one thing I want to bring up about reclaiming that I think sort of folds into what we were just talking about, but also is a facet that I think is really important for folks to understand, is that one of the things that we say in classes as an agreement, you know, sort of moving into magical spaces or even in rituals too, is that you are your own spiritual authority rooted in community. And that means that, yes, your experience is your experience and you don't have to follow anyone else's lead. You don't have to do it the way they do it. So I sometimes say when I'm in a trance, like, you don't have to lay down to do this. You can walk around. But the second part of this phrase is rooted in community, which acknowledges that your actions and your choices have an impact on other folks. So just because this is the way you do it, notice and understand that that might impact someone else. So you may need to navigate that too. So be your own authority. However,
self-awareness. Mm-hmm. Self-awareness is the biggest thing. So I have actually that, because that was one of my favorite parts of the the principles of unity. Mm-hmm. That is what we called. Each of us embodies the divine. Mm-hmm. Our ultimate spiritual authority is within, and we need no other person to interpret the sacred to us. Yes. We foster the questioning attitude and honor intellectual, spiritual, and creative freedom.
Yes.
And this is, so now I guess we have to walk behind that curtain.
Behind the curtain.
So you have a large number of people throughout the world.
Yep.
Who believe, I do, but it just makes me laugh because I know me. Who have a questioning attitude. Intellectual, spiritual, and creative freedom are most important to them. Mm-hmm. And you sort of have to have a blanket that covers all of them.
Yes, that is helpful to have. You know, reclaiming is designed to be a non-hierarchical tradition. So if everyone is at sort of the same level, like, is there something we can all agree to? And the principles of unity is, I can't imagine being in that meeting when they first created that. That must have been such a thing. And it's also been changed a couple times, because as we've grown and evolved as a tradition, it's had to change because some people weren't finding themselves in there anymore. And that needed to change.
So that everybody feels that they're heard and answered.
I mean, hopefully.
And that, hopefully. And, well, you can't, like, I mean, I was thinking, sometimes issues overlap. Mm-hmm. Like, say, sure. For example, you have, which I am not taking sides, people, because I'm not, you have a vegan, and mm-hmm. then you have the indigenous right to hunt and, mm-hmm. and to live, because they find the animals sacred and a part yes. of their life. And mm-hmm. so there's going to, but you have a way of having a discussion. There's mm-hmm. a disagreement. Possibility there that you work with. So it's an interesting read, not just for reclaiming witchcraft, but for any group. I tend to be solitary because I'm getting older and I've done groups.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm like, okay. But it is a nice map for discussion mm-hmm. in a group where you want everybody to feel free or whatever.
We want everyone to feel heard. I think that is important. I think you're referencing the consensus part of the book. And that is, I mean, it's a decision-making process that a lot of activist groups have used. And so it's not just reclaiming, but it does hopefully allow every voice to be heard. However, in the end, decisions are hopefully made, you know, in service to community as a whole. So that doesn't mean that everybody gets their thing.
No, you can't. Everybody can't have their thing.
No,
it can't happen. But you try to come as to everybody being heard, and because people don't feel heard, they get upset.
It is not a great place to be.
No, when was the last time that they made changes?
The last changes were made in 20. So the most current one is in Honoring the Wild. Because hilarious, here's a nice little side note. As soon as reclaiming witchcraft was done, A couple months later, the book was done. A couple months later, they changed the principal's immunity. And that's a bummer.
And did you feel hurt?
I was like, oh, that's such a great example of being an evolving tradition. I thought it was fantastic. So the most recent change was 2021. I just want to make sure that I'm right, because it was first created in 97 and then updated in 2012 and then updated again in 2021.
So do you ever have, I am just curious if you lose people whenever something like this happens because of disagreement. So there is.
And oh, yeah.
And it's just part of that, you know, you're going to, right?
You're absolutely going to. And the other trick is that when you have I imagine it's a trick, when you have a tradition that's so spread out, you can't get everyone's voices into all of these conversations. You just can't. You can try. And so people can feel left out. And that's happened and publicly it's happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to watch too.
Because you don't want anybody to feel that way, but it's also part of growing. I mean, as a human and as a group, you have to understand that you can't always.
Oh no!
It's the nature of a group. So there's a maturity there that has to come out.
I don't have the same friends that I had when I was in grade school, right?
No.
Like I don't, and because we're different people at this point, I don't think we'd recognize each other at this point, which is, like you said, part of growth and part of, I don't know, figuring out what's true for you in this moment. And you know, the beginning part of Principles of Unity didn't talk about folks who didn't identify with like a god or goddess, right? They wanted to identify with mysterious ones or having what I would say is just a broader definition of deity, or maybe not deity, but mysterious ones, however you define that. And so that was a big deal. And some folks, you know, weren't real keen on it. And I also think that I personally think that the more space we can make at a table, like it's not taking away from what I think is, you know, what my jam is. Great. More definitions. Fantastic. It doesn't impact my practice. And And then the most recent one was more about anti-racist and really being upfront that we're an anti-racist tradition.
Which was
not stated before, not in a way that the BIPOC folk of our community felt like it was actually being stated. Like we weren't really, like the principals union didn't read like we were taking a strong position on that.
So it's interesting, aside from the witchcraft tradition, just to see the interactings of people in society at this time and how different wording and that, like you have to be very, I mean, when we talk about writing and being concise with your wording and specific, you have to be very concise with meanings and stuff.
It's a navigation. There's a lot of moments of adjustment. And there's also the idea that not all trans folks are monoliths either. Some folks don't like what we've been quote unquote told is okay. You know, it's a constant sort of figuring out how to hold other folks in the way that they ask to be held, not how we think should happen, because it might be easier to use whatever it seems.
Yeah, no, this is not easy.
No.
This is not easy at
and
all.
Good.
And it's interesting. It's interesting to talk about these kind of dynamics in a group situation. So with the group, with the idea of group, as always, you have more resources, you have more experiences, you have more places that you can fit, whether you're bringing along the transportation or the snacks or whatever may be needed in the time.
You have
all of those things going for it. But on the other hand, you need to get along with other people and to listen and maybe put yourself second. I mean, that's Mm-hmm. That's the point of a group, is to put yourself second for mm-hmm. the group. Mm-hmm. That is clearly to me the definition of what a group is.
Of a working community. Yes. Yeah. I think that's good.
So mm-hmm. so with those goods and those bads, I can't believe I just said it that way, but that's good. Normally, I mean, they're not.
Humans aren't perfect.
I try to think of good only being a word for dairy products. You know, they're good and bad. Everybody else like has that. Faces.
I dig it. Yeah, the binary is tricky. The binary is very limiting.
So what attracted you? What, like you said, you were interested in that, but you've stayed for quite a while now.
Yeah. What attracted me to reclaiming?
Yes. And staying, like giving you the staying.
Yeah. And staying. That's actually probably an even more interesting question. Yeah. I would say that what was attractive to me is that I read Spiral Dance when I was a younger, growing up in the Midwest, you know, hiding it from everybody. And I was like, oh my gosh, these people are so amazing. And then I moved to California. I was like, oh, they're real people. And so I got interested in it because through a series of events, I happened to go to a California witch camp and got to be in magical space with like 100 other people for a week. I knew nothing about what I was doing. It was the most intense. I literally knew no one, and intense, indescribable to a certain extent experience. And I came back going, this is home. Like, I don't know anything about this still, but this is home. And it was the community, it was the magic, it was the ecstasy, it was the just, it was so what I would call authentic, mm-hmm. which sounds sounds judgmental to other traditions, but that's not what I mean.
No, but it spoke to you. We'll put it,
it spoke to where I was at. Yeah. And so after that, I took like all the classes and things like that. And I met like my local community and then started to plan rituals and things like that. And then I started teaching and, you know, teaching and more teaching and more meetings and more meetings and more meetings. And, you know, throughout all that, I learned so much about how to interact with folks in magical spaces, but also in many meetings, because there's a lot that goes into a ritual. There's a lot that goes into the principles of unity. And there's a lot that goes into meeting community where they're at in the moment, as much as you can. And I think the reason why I stick around is because I've been through conflicts. I have been through really amazing growth periods. And throughout all of that, I watched people be really committed, mostly, not everybody, committed to working through things, even when it got tough, even when it got, you know, kind of harsh at a few points. But people were willing to work through things and to listen to each other and to find ways to hold each other where they were at and where they wanted to go. So for me, that is what keeps me around. There are days where it's, you know, it's not, there are days that are hard. And there have been periods of time that have been hard. And I stick around because to a certain extent, when I got initiated, I decided this was the tradition that I was, you know, that I was married to. And I was going to stick around because, you know, in a lot of relationships, stuff doesn't always go well all the time. And
well, no, that's just the thing with relationships. They occasionally take work. I'm not going to say they always take work because right. there are mm-hmm. those magical moments, probably more in a witchcraft tradition.
I mean, having rituals is great. Yes.
So bringing it back to books, because I always do, this mm-hmm. was the book that changed your life.
I think that that is a fair assessment. I think that it was a really big turning point. I had read other witchcraft books at that point, and this was the one that felt accessible at that point.
And that was, The Spiral Dancer.
Spiral Dance by Starhawk.
Spiral mm-hmm. Dance. That's in the book. So, so it's important that different philosophies in that are available to people out there to read, because can you imagine what your life would be like if you hadn't had that?
I think that between that book, which I think would have been, you know, I was in the Midwest and I didn't have groups, so I was pretty solitary at that point. And I think really what, you know, promoted everything for me was being in community with reclaiming folks and being in large groups and also being a part of building communities together, which is, you know, no small task.
Because especially we're talking pre-internet
well, popularity. Yeah, I mean, reclaiming was for a while. When I got into it, internet was a bit more at that point. And I mean, I don't remember the years for any of that. But I couldn't tell you. I know I read Spiral Dance in 98-ish.
Okay, and so
I consider myself a reclaiming witch since then, because that really resonated. I got into community around 2008. And because I was out here, I moved here and went to camp in 2008. So, but started, you know, planning rituals for our local community in 2009. And
so did you move out because of that reason?
I did not. It was for a completely different reason. But because I moved out to California, I ended up having a connection to somebody who was in reclaiming. Like, it was all very
it worked.
Yeah, it really worked. It was very, very strange. And it ended up being, you know, one of the most life-changing things for me.
So the one thing that we wanted to get out, though, is that it is an encompassing group. It is, you know, come in there. And Iris Lanya has seen a lot. She's been there for a long time. She's seen some things, people. But it is an open, everybody's included, definitely, and a very open, friendly place to learn about things. You don't have to, it also said that you don't have to go in there saying, I'm going to be a reclaiming witch. You can stick around and learn what it's all about. And that's probably best.
I agree. It's dating the tradition. Date it for a little bit. Get to know folks. Figure out if that's your jam. And figure out if that resonates for you. I mean, to a certain extent, you know, reclaiming, you know, is often a tradition that's best experienced versus read about. I mean, there are plenty of books now. Not plenty. You can always have more. But I think that there's something about being with people that is just, it makes more sense than me explaining it.
Well, yeah, it's the experience. It's your own personal experience. We talked about experiences and it works the same way. But dating is the perfect segue into Aphrodite. I am very interested in Aphrodite before, and I, you know, tended to be more interested in like Celtic and Norse kind of deities. But you said at the beginning of this book that made me go, I think I'm interested in this. Aphrodite and I were never meant to get along. So obviously that changed. What changed it?
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite things. I was doing a presentation on that the other day, and I read that section again, and it's been a minute since I wrote it. And it's true. So like you just said, like about the Celtic and sort of the Norse, and when I first got into witchcraft, I was really interested in, over time, in the difficult deities, the ones that were sort of the taskmasters, or at least appeared to be. So I really wanted to work with Caradwyn. I wanted to work with Hecate. I wanted to work with, you know, whomever was the whatever, the powerful, like, I was going to swear. That's why I paused for a second.
I'm not sure if we're allowed to or not. I think we can.
Not sure either. So I was like, I'm gonna not say that. It's a bad, you know, bad whatever of deities. And so that's what I wanted to do. And I was like, of course. So Aphrodite to me was always portrayed as this soft and really gentle. And she sort of felt like a Barbie to me. And that just didn't work for me. And so I kind of pushed her aside and pushed her aside. And then at some point, I just was like, maybe I should, this thing I keep pushing aside, maybe it has something to teach me. And thus I took a class from a couple of beloveds of mine, and sort of, it's about courting the goddess and courting the gods, I think it's called now, but like courting and dating different deities to sort of, you know, figure out if you want a relationship.
Try them out.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So someday I'm going to do a class on like deity speed dating, because I think that would be fantastic. Someday. I haven't figured it out yet, but people have heard me say that. Anyway, so I was in this class and it was really lovely. And it was really like, gentle's not the right word, but it definitely was an energy I hadn't been exploring in myself. I was so like, I wanted to be tough and strong and like kind of scary. And I'm still that. But this class really helped me soften. And it showed that there was a deity who could support me in, you know, working towards the mysteries of love, which I don't know if anybody else is like this, but, you know, love is not easy. Love is often presents us with a mirror to ourselves and a mirror of what we could look at a little bit more deeply. So this work and working with Aphrodite became like, oh, wait, there's something here that actually is a part of me that I'm not looking at. And I took this class and sort of had this experience at the end of class, which it was aspecting, which is short answer, is possessory work, where you allow deity to come into you and hang out for a while. And I had that experience and it was transformative. And I knew that she was the one I wanted to build a relationship with. And then I kept having all these like strange little experiences after that where things would happen. And I was like, okay. And so we just started to date each other, you know, many, many altars and many, many ritual experiences. And sometimes it's hard for me to like talk about my relationship with her because it is so personal, and she is often in society just portrayed as something else. And she's so much more complicated. I read her stories and heard, you know, saw the stories where she's a jealous pain. And she's also like kind of headstrong and also involved like with, you know, Aries and war and, you know, all the things. She's complicated. And I resonated with that. And I was like, wait, how am I a person who also on the surface looks like this, but also has way more to offer? So, and also that being initiated into the mysteries of love is deep, challenging, and really rewarding work. She's my being outside of Iris, because that's where my name comes from. But Aphrodite offers a lot. And so I always encourage folks to give her a second look, because...
Well, I'm thinking about the image we have of Aphrodite, and I'm wondering, I mean, because I'm not against the show. I love the show, but I'm thinking about Xena.
I haven't seen this. I know people talk about this. I haven't seen that.
That's how she's portrayed, sort of as, you know, the stereotypical blonde and, you know, and diaphragm just. I wonder if that's gotten into our heads. But no, you talk about, you know, her relationship with family, and let's just say all the gods and goddesses are rather dysfunctional.
The Greek gods are a soap opera, and I love it to a certain extent.
I mean, but on that hand, you see that they are human. So I think one of the things, I don't have it here, but one of the things you suggested is to, if you're having the family love difficulty, is to look at her family. Yeah. And sort of say, okay, then, you know, you move this around here and you do this, which gets us to what I've always believed about myths and things, is that they're a template. They can be a template for our own lives.
They can be a guide, an inspiration. They offer a lot of insight. I often encourage folks to look at stories of deities and sort of place themselves in different characters in the stories to see how that shifts what they think about the story after the first time they've heard it. Because I think that, you know, obviously we create stories all the time of our lives, and I'm the victor or the victim or whatever. So when we can look at God's stories and myths and look at how they interacted, it does sometimes open up a little bit more perspective, sometimes wisdom and sometimes just humor. But I think that working with myth is such a strong way to connect with deity. And also myths are translated by certain people who have certain, I think, agendas. And so we have to think about that too.
Oh, definitely. And they've been changed over the years. Yes. I mean, they're public domain. Mm-hmm. So back to the seeing yourself in the story, to have perspective, we have to understand that we're all the people in the story. Yeah. We get mm-hmm. to be Aphrodite and Aries, and somebody's yes. always going to see us in a different character than we're seeing ourselves.
Absolutely.
So mm-hmm. it's important to try yourself out in the story mm-hmm. as it's going. And I'm also thinking, now that I'm here, for any writers that may be listening out there, you can put yourself in that story and end up with a novel. Like, there's so many yep. places to go. So
that is, mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting. I think it would be really fascinating to see. I'd love to hear more stories of Aphrodite in modern day. You know, I think that would be really fascinating. I think I was talking to somebody the other day who was writing their dissertation on Greek deities, and they were talking about Aphrodite in video games. Like, how neat would that be, right?
Yes, yes. No, because that's where we start our love of mythology. Mm-hmm. Is as stories. Children and through, I mean, I have always been a Thor mm-hmm. fan just because of a cartoon that was out when I was a child.
Right?
And it was and now when I look yeah. back, I think, and was never really big into superheroes, but mm-hmm. Thor clicked because what? He yeah. was mythology, and it was an mm-hmm. old story and long ago. And I think we crave that longevity in our stories.
Well, we can make meaning of our lives by seeing how meaning is made of other stories, right? Mm-hmm. We can sort of say like, okay, this happened, and because of this, this happened. And we go, oh, okay, in my life, this happened, and maybe I can figure out the meaning for that, and that'll help me with my next decision or things like that. I know when you talk about like who inspired you as a child, I think of Wonder Woman. So like Wonder Woman, whole ethos there.
And yes.
I actually wrote about her in one of my upcoming books because I think of Artemis.
But it does. Oh, we have a question from Brian. I'm going to trust him and show it. I'm trusting you, Brian. The Incomplete Enchanter series by Sprague de Camp explored what would happen when we began interacting with various classical gods and goddesses.
Cool.
A bit dated, but fun to read.
Love it.
So I guess Brian knows all those books.
Love it. Big fan. I'm so interested in all that because I think, I personally think, I don't speak for all the gods, but I really think that the gods love it when we continue to tell stories about them and say their name a lot.
Well,
I think that that is, I would imagine, I think that we've also probably given them egos. But I think that that's a way to keep things alive is by telling stories. And even if they're not all the same, that's okay. You know, I think that not all stories resonate with everyone, and some stories will.
I think there is a place for, you know, so that you can always go back to mm-hmm. the original story. But mm-hmm. I do think even in the beginning, I mean, you went from village, the storyteller would go from village to village, mm-hmm. telling the story that village needed to hear.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In that yes. time. So it would, right. it would change between having an abundant year for hunting or a bad year for hunting, you know, and so the stories would change and the heroes mm-hmm. to reflect the people in the audience and maybe make one look. I mean, because like they also got to get
right.
money on the side. So you want to, mm-hmm. you make a god out of the person that's sitting there. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So So I think it is, but yeah, no, what you were saying clicked. The stories for dating, when you get to know them, and it's the same as dating, you get to know their story, you sort of know which deity you want to hang out with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot in terms of dating. So thinking about, you know, what is one of the first things you do when you kind of meet somebody? Often people will Google them. And so that's what I do with deities too. I Google them and I kind of go like, what are people saying about you? Because I think that's interesting, even if it's not all true, like just getting a sense, you know.
You're completely right. But I'm just thinking of this gossip call with like Thor and
you know, it's called it's the Odyssey, right? And the Iliad.
Right.
And I think that that's, I mean, how do you get to know somebody? You start like asking like, what do you know about this person? And what should I look out for? And then, but you have to build the relationship to figure out what's true. But it's still, you know, I think that pretty sure it's would be the first thing I would do would be to ask.
So that also, I mean, how much are we communicating when we are actually dating, you know, or sitting there? Because what the person says, I used to ask, what do you want to be when you grow up? People are not necessarily what they wanted to be. And what they wanted to be was, you know, then my husband said a real life Indiana Jones, and I got caught up in the story.
Of course.
Stories are powerful.
Stories are powerful.
I like that. So yeah, follow the story.
Follow the stories. And yeah, I mean, I think that it would be wise to say in this moment, apply some critical thinking, but also, I mean, stories also to entertain sometimes. It's not just to inform. Sometimes it's to inspire. And I think inspiration is a great outcome.
Stories are important.
Absolutely.
They make us happy. They make us sad. They inspire us. They bring understanding.
They make sense of the world. Absolutely.
The whole caputus. So fact is not, I often find that stories are more honest than fact. Fiction is more honest than what we hear of fact, right?
Yeah. Hard to discern facts these days. Yes.
Yes. Is that. So no, that's another form of writing, which is on my list of the many, many things that you do, is you're also a poet.
I am. Yeah. I've been doing that for way longer than anything. I love it because poetry can really come into like the ritual work that I do. And, you know, I write a lot of things for gods and things like that in the various books that I've written. But this year I decided to self-publish a poetry book because I went through a long period in my life where I was, a lot of folks died. And I was, thank you. A lot of folks died, a lot of things died in my life. And I started to just write about grief and to like try to like get it out there because like we've said, story is really important for folks. And I think that story and poetry allows folks to see that, oh, I'm not alone in feeling like that. I'm not alone in feeling kind of messy. And so I wrote a lot of poems about that. And I do have one that I think would probably be interesting for folks.
Yeah, no, go.
Great, so this is, so the title of this one is The Gravity of Grief. And I cannot remember when I wrote it, but it was last year, I think. All right. I forgot that processing grief is not an exorcism, even though the yelling and screaming and asking for it to leave are the same, saying certain words, certain waters to settle the one who is uninvited. I forgot that processing grief is not a bandage you can quickly rip off and wince with the sting quickly, or have someone else do the ripping. It is slower, and speed is not a kindness. Today, I think of grief as a slow drip, like syrup sticking to everything before it hits the ground. Slow, bulbous, heavy as rain that gathers, unable to hold itself in the clouds. the sensation of holding on until the last possible moment, and even then. Grief covers and coats, and unless you're close to home, to a warm place with dry things, you will be waterlogged for a bit. The kind of wet and cold that layers can help, eventually. So remember this. Take time, take care. The way of any grief is just the way of it.
That imagery is amazingly astute. It is very, very, and it helpful to other people, as you said, but also cathartic to yourself.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of writing to make sense of this world and to really give attention to the small instances of life that don't seem like a big deal, but really have a lot to teach me or to teach others. So I usually write about little snapshots that expand into something else.
Because that's all you can do is take that moment. Right? Mm-hmm. You can't. So that, and if you join, follow whatever it is now, Iris Anya's Facebook page or whatever, mm-hmm. She has puts up many poems, and also there's her book. Is that the one, Wrecked?
Yes, it's Wrecked. It's called Wrecked, The Insistence of Grief.
At the end, and that's a work of your poetry going through this time in your life.
Yeah, it's a collection of things. I started just writing. I call it spontaneous poetry. I just sort of write stuff and throw it onto Instagram, and that's where it happens. And then I put it into a book.
So you get that immediate gratification as a writer, plus.
You know,
human.
I studied poetry, and so I know that getting it published is tricksy. And so I was like, I'm just going to do it. I would rather be messy and human and invite other folks to do that, because
what you need to stop making judgments.
Right.
Yes, messy is human. It's artsy. You need mm-hmm. to make a mess to make art and create. So you need to make a mess to create yourself.
The other day I said very offhandedly to someone, even as an Aphrodite person, so I'm saying this and I'm surprised to say this, but that beauty is a gatekeeper. Sometimes in our desire to make things beautiful, it stops us from actually doing the things that we want to do. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to sit with that. I'm a big fan of messy, big fan of it.
Yes. Yes. Jan said, what a beautiful grief poem. Yeah. I was saying it. And it is. So there is your thank you, Jan, for mm-hmm. listening and commenting. And Brian had an interesting comment. Your movement seems centered on European Hellenic deities. Do folks in other countries' cultures try to forge links to other deities?
So when I hear this, I think of like reclaiming being centered on that. And I don't think that's true. I think that I tend to be because it is something that I feel I'm not stepping into cultural appropriation with. And also, these are the gods that I've worked with the most. Do folks in other cultures try to forge links to other deities? So here's the thing. Aphrodite, is also thought to be sort of alongside Ishtar and sort of came over with the traders. And so I think that I don't think gods are ever just in one place. I think that there's a lot of influence that's come from different cultures and different countries. This is why I say that no story is like you have to look at many stories, because they're interpreted different ways by different people in different cultures.
For example, mm-hmm. she popped up as Venus in Rome. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of gods and goddesses will pop up in different cultures with a different name.
Yeah, I think that what might be helpful to say is that, because sometimes folks ask the question of like, do you like mix up deities or mix up pantheons? I work with deities across Greek and Norse, mostly, and some other deities. So I do work with different folks. Do I work with them together? Not necessarily. But also, I think they could. I think Freya and Aphrodite would get along great. I think.
Okay, that's a whole new thing to think about.
I think some deities wouldn't necessarily. But that's me.
I think there would be a tendency to work with your own for, as you said, appropriation. When you're messing with the story, you don't want to mess with somebody else's. And when you're making, and two, because it's sort of, it's the one that our ancestors listened to. So there would be things that we might relate to on that level that are still part of our upbringing or sayings in the family that we didn't even realize.
Right. And to be very clear, there is no Greek in my background. I've also worked with deities that I've also been called to. And I think that here's where cultural appropriation is a thing. And I could talk about this forever, but I'm not going to. One of the things that I think is important is if you're called to a deity, great, go work with them. There's nothing stopping you. It's when you go and you try to take from that culture and sort of say, like, I'm an expert in this, please pay me. I think that that's where we draw the line. Like, that's where I draw the line. Like, if anything, I do try to give back to the cultures that I do work with because I think that's an exchange. And also, I haven't necessarily just worked with Aphrodite for 2 days and, popped up in Aphrodite mystery school, that I know of.
So first of all, the first thing we learned is no, people work with all different gods and goddesses, whether they be Egyptian or South American. And second of all, is that Ivasanya is never without opinion. Okay. That's said in the most lovely, joyful way. I'm impressed. So there we go. So yes, people look into, if you're interested in reclaiming the Reclaiming Witchcraft movement, if you're interested into ideas of how to make, I never thought of it before, but it is sort of a handbook on ways to try to encompass a group in while holding everybody, and definitely look at Reclaiming Witchcraft and Honoring the Wild. Aphrodite gives lots of hints on how you might celebrate her, and whether it's things. We all like to have that merch. Aphrodite is not merch, but the symbol.
She's tricky. Yeah, with that. She likes pretty stuff. Yes.
So definitely pick up Aphrodite and then Rekt for the poetry. So you thinking we're pretty good here?
I have tons of stuff that's going on that would take too long to list. So my website is the best place to find stuff. And I have like a monthly-ish newsletter that comes out that's pretty detailed and things like that. Just go to my website and it's all the stuff. And I teach classes online and do various other things.
So
and I've written a bunch of other books too.
Yes, she has. Once again, it's like these. You can't fit people into an hour. Okay, yeah, just doesn't happen. So yeah. You're always welcome to come back. Just give us
absolutely
a chance and say,
great,
hey, you up for Fika? And I'll be like, fine. And if you're listening on any of the platforms out there, in the show description, her links should also be there for you and writing concrete. You could see them and possibly even click on them. So
it's very easy to Google me.
She is very easy to Google.
I did.
Easy to Google. We will get you a bumper sticker. That's easy to Google.
For it.
So you take care and hopefully we see you again. And thanks for all the sharing that you did today.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really had a great time.
Okay, I'm good. I'm glad. Then you'll come back. Okay. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. Absolutely.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we brought her back. Okay. Thank you for listening, everyone. It was a great discussion. And as usual, I want to thank you all for listening. Until we meet next week. May your coffee be hot and your stories sweet. And we're going to get out of this show without any major